Hey, it's Luke Black, proud owner of The Marketplace. Since 1980, we've been your neighborhood sandwich shop. We're open Monday through Saturday for breakfast and lunch. And now, open for dinner, Monday through Thursday, 4 to 8. If you're craving a fresh sandwich, salad, soup, or a hot cup of local roasted coffee, we've got it all made fresh daily. The Marketplace can cater your next event, from small office lunches to full wedding parties. You can rent our space for private gatherings after hours. You can find The Marketplace at 246 Olmsted Boulevard in Pinehurst. It's not just a sandwich, it's an experience.
This is Taking Aim, a weekly show hosted by David Hensley and Stephen Woodward. Join us for open season on hypocrisy, deception, woke culture, and uniparty cronies. We'll review the stories you might have missed and prepare you for what's to come in the week ahead. Taking Aim starts right now.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to your favorite Saturday morning program heard exclusively here on WEEB. This is Taking Aim, and I am Steve Woodward, delighted to be joined today by Robert Bortons, the occasional co-host of this program, CEO of Classical Conversations, the homeschooling empire here in Moore County, also the president of the Moore County Republican Men's Club, and the host of the fabulous podcast Refining Rhetoric, available wherever you find your podcast. Good morning, Robert.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good morning, everybody.
You bet. Thanks for coming in. We do not ever begin our program without acknowledging our sponsor, the Marketplace Restaurant and Catering, since 1980. Your go-to for breakfast and lunch, and Monday through Thursday, 4 to 8, dinner at the Marketplace. Also, the recommended caterer in the community for intimate gatherings or the wedding of the century. And I have to put in a special plug for the breakfast burritos, which I sampled earlier this week, the Guajijo Amigo. And I did a little homework. Guajijo is a sauce made with guajijo peppers.
Oh.
And these are served on homemade tortillas and with a house-made cilantro lime crema sauce. I'm telling you, this is the premier burrito in all of the region.
Yeah, my mom and I went there for lunch just earlier this week, so it's a wonderful restaurant.
Wonderful staff, owner Luke Black, great guy, great American. So we salute our sponsor, the Marketplace Restaurant and Catering. Well, you know, Public Enemy Number One kicks off our program every week, and I have to say I've never had an easier decision in picking that dubious honoree, who is former governor of North Carolina, and I'm glad that he's former, but unfortunately he's current candidate for U.S. Senate as a Democrat, running in this year's midterm election for the seat being vacated by spineless Tillis. Tom Tillis.
Yeah.
The Republican opponent, of course, is former RNC chairman Michael Whatley. So it's Whatley versus Cooper, and I think I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that the Whatley campaign has got a treasure trove of campaign ad material, courtesy of a independent journalist who we will hear from later in the program, Stephen Horn, who, I'll use the cliche because it applies, blew the lid off a story that goes all the way back to 2021, when we were all being locked down by then Governor Cooper amid the hysteria, the manufactured hysteria of the COVID-19 Wuhan pandemic. Cooper got into a little legal tussle with the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, which is debatable whether they're actually interested in civil liberties. And he ended up settling a lawsuit which required him, the governor, this man of great power, bowing to the ACLU, releasing all of these very dangerous criminals from our prisons. And he is, because of that, easily public enemy number one this week. So Robert... think about this. It almost seems like this is a Babylon Bee story. Like this couldn't possibly have happened.
Yeah, while he was locking all of us up in North Carolina, he was unlocking the jail cells. And I know you're going to go through those details later this show, but I mean, he let out over 50 murderers, many of them who have murdered again since he let them go.
Yeah, 53 serving life sentences, 70 convicted of murder.
Wow.
203 convicted of indecent liberties with a child. And more than half of those have gone on to reoffend.
Wow.
Which is a nice way of saying commit more
murders and rapes.
Violent crimes against innocent people and specifically children. Now, the good news about this, if there is any, and it's silver lining, I guess, it's the middle of a campaign in which Cooper has led in all the polls and is presumed to have a rather sizable advantage in fundraising because of all the dark money that will come in from out of the state to support him. But he now has to contend with the fact that in the General Assembly, the Senate leader Berger and House Speaker Hall have formed a legislative subcommittee to investigate this secret reentry settlement list that Cooper was behind, opening the floodgates to these criminals, and then, perhaps as egregiously, doing the bare minimum to inform the public that they were released. In other words, this settlement was supposed to have occurred under the cover of darkness, and we were never supposed to know about it. And then, bada bing, bada boom, a couple of independent journalists do a little work, which I know is journalists and work don't always appear in the same sentence. But in this case, now the lid is blown off this thing. And if I'm the Whatley campaign, I'm churning out an ad a day just on this data alone.
Yeah, I know you're going to talk about it later, but I know Whatley's going to be well-funded. And they're saying they're going to spend combined over $1 billion on this race between all the PACs and fundraising. And so, be prepared for the most expensive Senate race in U.S. history. And, someone who is going to put innocent lives at danger by letting hardened criminals go. We saw that poor young lady being murdered in Charlotte. That guy could have been let go by Cooper. I'm not sure those details.
That is in fact the case. And the Cooper campaign has tried to weasel around that, saying that Brown was had been early released or something, but that's prior to this mass release. That has been disproven. In our conversation coming up later with independent journalist Stephen Horn, we'll talk about that among other things. But yeah, the literal blood of this Irina Zarutska is on the hands of a candidate for U.S. Senate, Roy Cooper. That's not an overstatement.
If he was a man of integrity, he would drop out of the race today.
Yeah, it seems to me that is a highly disqualifying stain on his record. But, let's not forget the other things. Let's not forget the businesses that shut down because of his tyrannical behavior during the pandemic. Let's not forget about the learning loss, a subject near and dear to your heart, of kids in our public schools who were, how many months were they out of school? A whole school academic year and then some in many cases. Some to this day have not recovered in terms of their reading and math proficiency and just social interaction and mental health. All of these things at the feet of one man, Roy Cooper. And he wants to be a U.S. senator. I have to say that I would be happy to have Tom Tillis stick around rather than have Roy Cooper in the beneath the dome. But
Ted Budd was down a similar percentage at this point in the last race, and so it's very. I don't think that Michael Whatley's way too far behind to come back and win by a couple points.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. So. And as I said, a great interview coming up with Stephen Horn on this entire subject. We will segue now, very naturally, into public embarrassment number one. And once again, not limited to just an individual in this case, but to thousands of our public school teachers here in North Carolina, and in some cases their students. And in some cases, members of boards of education, including one from here in Moore County, taking to the streets of Raleigh on May Day, May 1st, tens of thousands. More than 20 North Carolina school districts were closed on Friday, May 1st, so that these teachers could take the day off and go march in the streets. And the thing that came to light is that this was just another anti-Trump, Trump as a Nazi, no kings kind of rally, with just a slightly different theme being, you know, more money for kids and less money for big, evil corporations. But just as a taste of how unhinged these teachers were, let's go to some sound from that march in Raleigh. Let's play clip one.
We're out here on International Workers' Day, marching alongside thousands of teachers and public school workers, bus drivers, cafeteria workers, everyone that makes our schools function, demanding that North Carolina pay up, fund our schools, pay our teachers what they need to make, and stop the cuts to public education.
These intelligent, very mature individuals have 8 hours a day with our kids in classrooms. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, that doesn't make me feel good at all. I guess it makes it feel good for my business, Classical Conversations, because we're helping families homeschool and get their kids out of these woke indoctrination centers that our public schools have become, unfortunately, intentionally. Yeah, 600,000 students in North Carolina were out of school on a Friday. And why didn't they wait? I mean, it's almost finals time. So these kids are, one, not going to be as prepared for finals. Two, you've got all of these, you know, dads and moms who are, you know, probably have to take the day off work. So it's hitting their pocketbooks, or, you know, they're having to pay someone else to watch their kids. And then you have, these teachers and that are just kind of up there being good little socialists, trying to tax us more. The General Assembly has given more money to education in the North state of North Carolina than ever before. And at least nationwide, I don't know what it is in North Carolina, only 36% of kids could rate at grade level. So why don't those teachers get them up to like 80 or 90%? And then we can talk about a raise. Like, no business would give someone a raise who is only 36 proficient at their job.
Yeah, 36%. And by the way, it's worse in North Carolina. It's more like in the low 30s for reading and math, both at the fourth and eighth grade levels. So that means between the fourth and the eighth grade, which is the testing years for these performance tests, over that span of time, they're not improving.
Yeah.
Their proficiency levels remain beyond mediocre. And yet these teachers are threatening not only do more of this kind of protesting, but they're shouting strike, strike, strike. Well, I have a little fun fact for them. In the state of North Carolina, a public employee, a state employee, is prohibited from striking. This is a work state, as they call it. Our unions here are unions in name only. They do not have the ability to send teachers out on a picket line to strike. That can't happen here.
Well, yeah, in North Carolina, their name union is a name only, and everywhere in the United States, actually, Steve, their union's a name only. Because what are unions supposed to do? They're supposed to get you good pay and safe work environments, and none of these teachers, you know, why are they striking? Because their union's obviously not doing their job. The number one reasons that teachers leave the profession is safety. And so thank God that our school board had the foresight, or is working with our sheriff's department now to make sure our schools are safe. You know, some of the Democrat-leaning people did not want that to happen. And that's why, and also, we did not shut down our schools on May 1st because we have a good school board. Other school districts, because you're not allowed to strike, you're not allowed to walk out of work, actually shut down their school. And so that's why these school board races are so important going forward here. So absolutely atrocious behavior, but it's one expected because many of these people are trained Marxists, because the teachers' colleges in our country specifically train them to become Marxist.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're seeing the fruit of the labor of the indoctrinators at the college level, because now their former students are graduating with these degrees in education and going on to become school teachers. And they are not driven by some moral duty to educate and raise citizens who are informed and mature, but they are trying to raise indoctrinated zombies who want to take to the streets every time they're given a chance. And that's what we're seeing.
Yeah. Well, Frederick Douglass, former slave, great American, said, you know, once you can read, you know, you're forever free. And so the fact that we have only 36% of kids reading at grade level in the United States, more than half of U.S. adults now read below a sixth grade level. And so, you know, these people are, you know, voting on laws and, you know, elected officials when more than half of them can't even read what they're voting on or read enough to comprehend what the words mean. You know, they might be able to sound it out. And so this is very dangerous to keeping our republic, as Benjamin Franklin once said.
Yes, if we can keep it. Well, and if they aren't freed from the shackles of stupidity by not learning how to read, they can just run for elected office, and works out pretty well. And then they don't read the bills, they just vote on them. One elected official who is doing his part to put the iron boot on these unions is the governor of Idaho, who in recent days signed a bill that will prevent school districts from collecting dues directly from teacher paychecks and will limit the ability of teachers' unions to recruit members during school hours. I think that's a kind of a no-brainer, isn't it? It will also end the practice of giving teachers pay time off for union activities, quote unquote, such as what we saw in Raleigh on May 1st.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you think these unions are about the teachers, you know, I know the teachers might believe that, but they would be wrong. They're basically appendages of the left, of the hard left, of the radical Marxist left in this country. Reported recently by an organization called Defending Education, a very good organization. Check them out online, defendinged.org. National teachers unions, listen to this carefully, have contributed more than $660 million to far-left organizations and left-wing political groups since 2015, so roughly over the past decade. The two largest teachers unions, which are the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association, of which there is a chapter here in North Carolina, they have handed out, it's really closer to $670 million in member dues and fees and political action committee funds to the following: left-wing political entities, far-left nonprofits, school board campaigns, and opponents of school choice legislation, of which there are many. The key takeaways from this report, which is damning for the unions, they probably won't be the least bit embarrassed, however, is that the unions and their PACs gave a combined $85 million to federal, state, and local Democrat Party entities. Also, you'll love this one. The two unions distributed over $10 million of member dues to state ballot initiatives. And here's one that really got my attention. They just had the race for governor in Virginia. In 2025, American Federations of Teachers contributed $500,000 to the Abigail Spanberger for Governor campaign in Virginia. She, of course, won that race handily and is now the Marxist Democrat governor of Virginia and has turning it into Caliginia or whatever. What are they calling it? Got to be careful how you say the word Virginia. But anyway, since 2016, an entity called Midwest Academy has received $1.7 million in funding from teachers unions, which is an organization that is part of a collective effort to provide training for May Day mobilization activities, which we just saw here in Raleigh. So this is kind of like, I don't know, organized crime, you know, doling out the dollars to all the people who they want to keep, you know, under their tight rein.
The Trump Department of Justice seems to have gathered enough evidence against the Southern Poverty Law Center to indict them on their criminal activities. And I hope they're looking at some of these teachers' unions. Randy Weingartner, who's the president of, I think, the AFC union, she's explicitly said she wants the United Nations to write the curriculum for all of American schools. And so these are not people who love America. These are not people who love liberty, that love our founding. They want to remake America in their own eyes, to be able to successfully merge us with collectivist Marxist states. And I reveal all of that in my book, Woke and Weaponized, which I know I've can't come and talk to you there. So we have the receipts. Go pick up a copy on Amazon.com. But it really is. It's not like my wife was a public school teacher for 10 years. She loved it. Like she loved the kids. There's a lot of those in our schools here in Moore County, right? They don't have a Marxist bone in them, but the system itself, and they're forced to, unlike Idaho, like in Idaho has that great law now, but so many states force them to give to their unions. Like they have no opportunity to say no. So the union is stealing money from them. They're not helping them get better jobs. They're not helping them get safer, workplace environments. And then they're funneling 99% of their money to the Democrat Party, which even like Hollywood doesn't give 99% of their money to the Democrat Party. I mean, this is the most extreme Marxist organization in our country. It's a reason why, you know, over 60%, I think, of Gen Zers think Democrat socialism is good, despite the fact that it's killed hundreds of millions of people over the last 125 years and would have killed a lot more if not. Thank you for all our veterans, for those who are serving at Fort Bragg today. That are keeping us free, but they're trying to import it through our schools.
And you know, I came across a stand-up comedian who sort of encapsulates the contrast between these people who, you know, like these lefties who are teaching in our classrooms and running these unions, and the intelligent members of the. You know, of the conservative MAGA movement. Let's play clip two.
Growing up in New York, I was always in rooms with liberals who just assumed I agree with them because I'm liberal passing. What I realized sitting in all those rooms is that liberals, they think that things are copacetic. You know, when we're in an office, you have a friendship with someone who has different political opinions than you do. They think it's because they're forgiving us for being evil. But what they don't realize is we're forgiving them for being retarded.
Oh, yes. Well, we try to forgive them. It's hard sometimes because they really do cause a lot of problems in a otherwise orderly and civilized society. That kind of problem reared its ugly head in Connecticut recently in a story regarding a homeschooling family, I believe. And this is a subject, again, that is that you follow very closely as a homeschooling advocate. What's going on in Connecticut?
Yeah, so every single homeschooling law for the last 75 years has been a positive one, making it more easy for parents to homeschool, to give their kids the education that their children deserve. And Connecticut passed a new law over the last couple of days, despite over 17 hours of testimony against it. It's a deep blue state, and basically requires every single homeschool family to check in with their local public school each year. And the local public school will determine whether they're fit to homeschool or not. Now, we've already covered that only 36% of kids can read at grade level. Probably about 99% of homeschool students read above grade level. So that's just a ridiculous idea. The school districts actually testified against it as well because they don't have the resources to do it. But despite all this backlash, the Connecticut House and Senate have passed this bill, and now it's on the governor's desk. I sent him a letter asking him to veto it. One of the things that's in this bill is they're requiring this Health and Human Services or the health department to share private information with the school district, which is illegal, explicitly illegal in this bill. So it just goes to show how much the Democrats hate individual liberty, how much they hate it when parents take charge of their child's education and get involved in it. And they're fine passing illegal bills that stomp on our civil liberties. I'm hoping that it gets vetoed by the governor, and I'm optimistic that if it doesn't, that it's going to go to court, and our courts will make sure that our laws are sane. But this just shows how extreme Democrats have gotten on education and how much they want to control our kids, because they understand that when parents are involved, that they lose their grip on them.
And they're swimming against the tide, aren't they? Because I don't know if you have the data, you know, off the top of your head, but I would imagine that on an annual basis, we're seeing a continuous movement of parents with children going from public schools to homeschooling.
Yes. Yeah. So in America right now, the public school system's losing 2% or so of students per year compared to what it's historically having. Homeschooling's growing about 10-15% per year. Private school's growing. The charter schools are growing as well. And of course, we also have a issue with not having enough babies right now in the United States. So liberals aren't having kids. That might benefit us in the long run. But we have a whole entire pyramid scheme of social services that require another generation. So between not as many babies being born as there are graduating, and the fact that parents are taking more control over their kids' education and making other decisions when they find out things like somewhere between 10 and 17% of high school graduates are sexually harassed by a school employee.
Hello.
In our public schools in the United States, that's not something that they want their kids involved in. And so that's why there's so many more choices.
And that leads me to an interview that I really loved coming out of all places, the Kentucky Derby, a week ago. But the winning jockey, Jose Ortiz, who I didn't know anything about, but he wins the race on this somewhat long shot horse from as far behind as you can come to win a Kentucky Derby.
Yeah.
I mean, from nearly the back of the field. And in the waning moments, awash with, you know, the basking of in this victorious moment, here is Jose Ortiz being interviewed by an NBC Sports reporter on horseback. And she asked him what his victory means beyond the racetrack, beyond the moment. Play clip three.
Jose, last question. When you were growing up in Puerto Rico, you looked up to Johnny Velasquez, a legendary jockey, Hall of Fame jockey. What do you want to say to the kids in Puerto Rico who are watching you today, dreaming of being a jockey?
It's a great question, Donna. Just to have good attitude, try to learn English, and try to learn every day more. It takes time. No, I've been here 11 years. This is my 11th year. And thankfully.
You're leaving out your incredible work ethic.
Yeah, it takes time. You gotta work, be responsible, respect people. And, I know they gotta know that I was sitting there 50 years ago in the same chair they're sitting. So it's not impossible. All dreams come true. They just gotta dream, but dream big.
Jose, I'm happy to see this dream come true for you.
Dream big. Great words. Great advice. And again, what did he say to these young Puerto Rican kids? Learn English.
Work hard.
Work hard. Basic stuff. And that is still, that very simple advice still can deliver a lot of positive results for young people in this country, because this country still delivers on the promise of unlimited potential for every human being who comes here legally.
Yeah, and it does it better than anyone else, and it does it because of our conservative values, despite the fact that it's been under attack. I mean, I remember when the European Union was formed, and all my leftist friends were like, this is so exciting, the EU, because of their progressive ideas, are just going to beat the United States and show that our ideas are better than everyone else's. Now, it's better to be poor in Mississippi, our poorest state, than to be middle class in Europe. That's how bad the EU has destroyed their economy. That our poorest, GDP state is now richer than their richest countries. There's two countries out of, you know, the entire EU that are doing well, and they're basically ones that have continually elected center right you know, politicians to lead their government and have rejected most of what the EU is doing. I'm sure NBC was not super happy that this is what his answer was. Things like work hard, learn English. But, you know, my grandparents on my father's side immigrated here. My wife's grandparents on her mother's side immigrated here during World War One, and that was the first thing they did was, or World War Two, was learn English, and work hard to integrate themselves into our society. And so when we have intelligent immigration system and things like that Trump's trying to do, bring in intelligent people into our country, it works well. But when we have criminals pouring through our southern border like the Democrats want, because they know that they can bribe them to vote for them, they, it doesn't work so well for our country. And so tip of my hat to this wonderful jockey, and yeah, dream big.
And you've just teed up a great immigration story. Play clip four.
I want to tell you a story of a young woman in particular that you probably have never heard of. Her name is Marianne. She was born on the remote island of Lewis in Scotland. This is a place of hard, scrapping life, high winds. It was 1930. She was 18 years old, and she got on a boat to come to Ellis Island in 1930 on May 2nd. Today is the anniversary. She arrived here 11 days later. She was bound for Ellis Island and the United States of America. I want to show you a picture. It's a painting that I did, and then I ran out of time and talent, and so I asked a good friend of mine to help me, Mike Malm, who is an amazing portrait artist. This is how I envision her coming into the United States. She came here, she wasn't chasing fame, she wasn't chasing riches or power. She came just for the opportunity. Her sister was already here and found a job. And so she decided to come. She stood in this room and wrote her name down, Mary Ann McLeod. And next to it, what's your job? Domestic. She and her sister were maids. She came to America knowing that she would serve and clean the houses and the toilets of the wealthy families here in New York, and she roomed with her sister together. And they lived and worked hard through the worst days of the Depression, and she persevered. She's here for 6 years, and she meets a man. She marries him. His name is Fred. He was the son of German immigrants. In 1942, she became a citizen, and Mary and Fred would end up having five children, two daughters and three sons. And one of those sons, they named him Donald. Her son would become a real estate tycoon. Her son would change that skyline. That's the skyline that she saw. Look out that window and look at that skyline. Her son, a woman who came here as a maid, the lowest of jobs, would raise a son who would become a real estate mogul and the 45th and 47th president of the United States of America.
You know, I have to say, I didn't really know that story in its entirety. I knew that President Trump speaks adoringly of his parents, both deceased now, of course, Fred and Mary. But that, you know, that story has repeated itself. That's the beauty of it. It has repeated itself over and over again. The children of immigrants haven't all gone on to become president of the United States, but they've gone on to be titans of industry, innovators, CEOs of companies, idolized athletes, entertainers, you name it. It goes on and on.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just shows you the power of self-sacrifice and working hard And these are things that the collectivists, the Democrat socialists, don't want to instill in our children, because these great things happen. And then you're not relying on the government to feed you and house you and clothe you. And, you know, how are they going to have control over you if you're able to take care of yourself? And so, you know, I think it's super important that, you know, America is a melting pot. But the idea of the melting pot is that they're adopting our values, they're adopting our language, and we're able to absorb them in a reasonable manner. And when you have an open border that we had, it's devastating. And it's devastating to the people who did it properly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's Sandy Moyer, I think, we heard a story from Pilar Page, or I pronounced her name wrong, the president of the women's club, about how her mom was a liberal, but she was so mad because she had immigrated here rightly from Argentina that mm-hmm. the southern border was open, you know. And so, I think it's a thing that can unite all of us.
We've been talking about great Americans, and I definitely want to mention one. His name is Brad McNeil, and I believe a native of Moore County, a longtime volunteer to patriotic causes across this community, passed away earlier this week after a brief illness. And we will miss Brad, and we want his family to know that they are in our prayers going forward. Brad McNeil, great American. We will miss him. We've got about a minute left, Robert, and you're the president of the Men's Club. So why don't you tell us about the June annual, 30th annual golf outing?
Yeah, so we've got our golf outing coming up. You can go to mcrmc.club, Moore County Republican Men's Club, initials.club, to go get registered today. We got hole-in-one competitions. It's best ball, putting. We got raffles. So if you can't be there, join our raffles. You can win a cruise. We got auction items if you want to go to Vail. So we have like a week-long stay in Vail. So, just go check out the website and go get involved. And it's a great way to make sure that Moore County stays conservative, because we're going to need a lot of funds. We know the Democrats are trying to turn Moore County blue. And we have the lowest taxes in the entire state, I think, in our county. And thank God for Republican leadership.
All right, so that's June 8th, Moore County Republican Men's Club golf outing. Go to mcrmc.club to register today. Joining us now is Stephen Horn, an independent journalist and the founding editor of the Triangle Trumpet on Substack. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. For those of you who are not familiar with what Stephen has been up to, let's just put it this way. He is a man who's been very much engulfed in his work lately, and for a very good reason. In the past, I don't know, is it past several weeks, we've been seeing these reports via X, also known as Twitter, of a Twitter site called Cooper Released Him, which is dedicated to the examination of the thousands of criminals, literally thousands of criminals, imprisoned criminals, released by then Governor Roy Cooper in 2021 during the grip of the COVID pandemic. And many of us have been caught off guard by this story because we're pretty sure that the governor never expected this information to become public. But Stephen, let's take us back to the beginning. The governor, Cooper is the governor. It's 2021. He's shut down the state in all ways imaginable because of the pandemic. Hysteria is rampant everywhere you turn. And along comes the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, and they are threatening to sue, I guess, the state of North Carolina or the governor or the North Carolina, prison system, to use a generic term, threatening to sue unless these prisoners, many serving very extended and serious sentences for very egregious crimes, They're threatening to sue unless all these people are released from the prisons. And why? To protect them from a mass outbreak of COVID-19. Now, I've been reviewing some of these records, and a lot of these inmates are younger individuals who probably, were they to contract COVID-19, would have had a bad cold for a few days. But that being what it is, why did Cooper acquiesce to the ACLU? Why did he agree to a settlement that involved releasing all of these 4,234 criminals, Stephen?
Well, I guess it depends how much credence you give to his explanation now versus, an analysis of how he has interacted with these left-wing organizations, which are, not always his allies, but definitely in the same ideological alignment. So now his defense is, oh, well, I fought them in court, but, the judge was ruling against us, so we had no choice but to let them out. But I think if you... If you look how he has aligned himself, who he has been talking to, if you look at his actions during Black Lives Matter, these are very much aligned with the general gist of these organizations, the NAACP, the ACLU, that they want to let criminals out of prison, period, because they see criminals being in prison as racist, because, mm-hmm. Criminals in prison are disproportionately non-white.
Yes.
And so that is the time period that this is going on in 2020 and early 2021 that these decisions are being made. I think if you look at Cooper's statements during that period, you'll see that, tells perhaps a different story than what he would like you to believe now in 2026, where popular opinion has kind of come around to, oh, actually, criminals are bad. They do crime. It's the same criminals doing the crime over and over again. And if you don't prosecute them, if you keep letting them out, they just keep doing more crime. And I think that's part of what this data exposes with the extremely high reoffense rate.
And we shouldn't get too far into this conversation without reminding everyone that then Governor Cooper is now a candidate for the United States Senate as a Democrat in this year's coming midterm elections. He'll be running against Republican Michael Whatley. Cooper has, as far as I know, has never had really a job, but has spent his entire adult life as an elected official. And this could throw a little curveball at him. So he settles with the ACLU to protect these criminals from COVID-19. And I still remember it today like it was yesterday, Cooper saying over and over again, follow the science, follow the science. Well, in this case, the science convinced him that murderers, rapists, child molesters, and other violent criminals needed to be released from our prisons. And here's where we are today. At least 2,412 of these 4,200 plus criminals granted release under this settlement have been convicted of an additional crime or post-release violation since being let out. Gee, what could possibly go wrong? And here's the breakdown from that Stephen Horn has provided us. Of the 53 serving life sentences, is that right? He let out 53 people serving life sentences. That's not a typo.
Yeah, it was previously reported as 51, but looking at the data showed 53.
Well, only one of those went on to reoffend, as they said, the polite word is to commit another crime. 70 convicted of murder, 9 have gone on to commit other crimes since their release. 99 convicted of rape or sexual offense. 45 of these choir boys have gone on to reoffend. And then of the 203 convicted of indecent liberties with a child, if you had more than half on your bingo card, you would be right. 119 reoffenders among that group. So overall, the reoffense rate for these released from prison in 2021 is even higher than the 57% indicated. And why is that? Because data provided by the NC Department of Adult Corrections typically omits crimes where charges were never filed or where charges were dropped or where the prosecution is in progress and has yet to result in a conviction. So 57%, probably north of 60% of these criminals that Cooper, Roy Cooper, let out of prison, have gone on to commit other crimes in the community, typically involving innocent citizens going about their everyday lives. So Stephen Horn, thank you again for joining us. You went beyond just the raw data. You have now meticulously looked at each one of these individuals, or you are in the process of doing so, and we're finding out specifically, you know, their names, their mugshots, their original offense that landed them in prison, and then their criminal history, because they all have rap sheets, quite lengthy ones in some cases, and then what they've done since they've been free from prison, thanks to Roy Cooper. Just randomly, I'm looking at Sidney G. Mayo in one of your more recent X posts. Everybody needs to go to Cooper Released Him. Search Cooper Released Him on X, a.k.a. Twitter, and you can read about Sidney G. Mayo, past the Mayo. Criminal history. Before her release, 5 criminal offenses on her record. Released in 2021. Offenses post-release, at least 2. And you put 2 plus because as we talked about earlier, we don't know in some cases the status of other prosecutions. So that's one. She is a robbery with a dangerous weapon landed her in the prison. Here's one. Quamterius Griffin. A male about 28 years old. Indecent liberty with a child, released by Governor Cooper in 2021. Pre-release offenses, at least 8. 8, folks. Releases post, offenses post-release, at least 1. And I could go on and on, but Stephen, where are you in this process? You're going through the records of 2,400 really bad guys and gals, and what is your overall takeaway? Is it you're probably not becoming sort of immune to shock at this point, I guess.
Yeah, you know, and that data is coming straight from the North Carolina Department of Adult Corrections. It's mostly a case of, you know, taking the list of offenders, you know, they're identified solely by their, you know, OPUS ID, you know, their identification number in that system, that in the release document, all it has is their number. So that this website is mostly just a case of taking that number and looking it up in the data that is published by the North Carolina Department of Adult Corrections as a sort of record. And you know, one of the reasons why the numbers there, you know, this is the minimum number of offenses, because if you look at the North Carolina Department of Adult Corrections website, you look up a particular offender, you can see that some of these convictions, you know, they sort of merge the convictions together for sentencing. So, you know, you're sentenced for multiple convictions at the same time. Well, the data set I'm working off of, for whatever reason, it doesn't expose all of that data. So it's only the primary conviction. So we know for a lot of these, this number is an undercount. You know, they were actually convicted of more offenses. Sometimes it's multiple, you know, crimes they committed at the same time that are sentenced at once, bundled together. Other times it's crimes committed over some period that, you know, for whatever reason, the judge or the prosecutors decide to bundle it together and they get sentenced all at once. And it only shows up as one line in this data that I'm using.
Right.
So it's pretty crazy. And the other factor is that this is sentencing data. So, you know, criminals like DeCarlos Brown Jr., who has been charged with murdering Irina Zarutska, he was arrested a number of times after his release. But in each of those cases, the Mecklenburg district attorney either dropped the charges or never filed the charges, or they're still in progress. And since this is a database of sentencing, you know, DeCarlos Brown doesn't even show up as a reoffender. And that's not even taken into account the fact that about half of crimes go unreported. They're never reported to the police. If you look at the FBI's survey, based on victimization instead of based on, you know, criminals that are arrested. Half of the crimes that are committed in the United States aren't even reported to the police. So the reoffense rate of 56-57%, that is very high, and that is probably significantly lower than the actual percentage of these criminals that have been released that went on to commit a crime. That's the number that has been sentenced in a court or found, you know, through the post-release revocation process, you know, the due process there of throwing them back in prison without an additional conviction if they violated the terms of their release.
We're conversing with Stephen Horn, the founding editor of Triangle Trumpet. Check it out on Substack.com. North Carolina independent journalist. You mentioned DeCarlos Brown. Now, the Cooper Senate campaign, when the Whatley campaign revealed that Brown was part of this mass release of criminals, the Cooper campaign tried to weasel out of that, as I recall, by saying, oh, no, that was not one of the criminals that were part of the Cooper release. What is the true story there, the actual story?
Well, if you look at the document that his subordinates reported to the court saying these are the offenders we released pursuant to this settlement, DeCarlos Brown is on that list. Yeah. So if they want to go, if he wants to make that argument, he can convince those lawyers to go to the court and say, hey, we were wrong. We told you we released this person pursuant to the agreement, and we actually didn't. Until I see that, I'm a little skeptical of their explanation. Right. Because basically their explanation is, oh, well, it happened before we actually signed the agreement, but we were allowed to count it. Well, why were they allowed to count it? Presumably it's because they knew this agreement was in progress. They knew this settlement was in progress a couple days before it was actually signed and filed with the court. And they were already starting to implement these criteria.
Yeah, so I'm just gonna go with then Governor Roy Cooper has blood on his hands in the death of Irina Zarutska on a Charlotte light rail because he was worried that DeCarlos Brown Jr. would be part of a super spreader COVID event. Let's just, you know, that's pretty much the bottom line on that story, and he was out of prison and she's no longer with us because he was let out of prison after what did he have 35. Priors or 25?
I don't think he was quite that high.
It was a lot.
So to be fair, he probably would have got out of prison in those, you know, 4 or 5 years anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So most of these criminals that were released early, you know, except for the criminals serving life sentences who may never have been released, most of these, you know, would have been released at some point between now and then.
Right. And my final question would be this. What reaction have you received, not in terms of media coverage, because I know there's been quite a bit of that, but what are you hearing from, the current governor's office, North Carolina General Assembly, the North Carolina, Attorney General? Is anybody interested in what you've discovered?
Yeah, well, the North Carolina legislature has convened a committee,
correct,
or perhaps a subcommittee to look into these releases specifically. I can't take any credit for that myself, but if they want to use my tool, great. Might help them get some insight to visualize some of these numbers, to sort through some of the criteria. And, you know, any of them are welcome to reach out to me. I've spoken to at least one on the subject, but, you know, I can't claim any credit for that. That was already in progress before the release of this site. In terms of the response from the public, obviously I'm seeing a lot of people who are, you know, shocked and incensed. And then on the other hand, you see people who are just like, well, Trump did this, or well, Whatley did this. It's like, okay, well, whatever. Like that doesn't really change what Cooper did when Cooper was governor. You know, Trump was never governor of North Carolina. Whatley has never been governor of North Carolina. So this is about exposing this particular data from the government. It's not data I'm coming up with. This is data from the North Carolina Department of Adult Corrections.
Mm-hmm.
And if your only response is to try to deflect, I think that says something about what this data is actually showing.
I agree with you completely. And let's keep something else in mind as well. just because one of these convicted criminals, murderers, rapists, child molesters, since the release to this moment in time, has not committed a crime, doesn't mean they won't. Doesn't mean they're not still out there lurking and imposing a threat to communities across North Carolina. And that's also bears repeating as we go forward with this story. Stephen Horn, I thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you for your work, and we hope to speak again with you in the future.
Thank you.
Well, as always, we thank all of you for sharing Saturday mornings with us. For David Hensley, I'm Steve Woodward. We're back next Saturday exposing deception, corruption, and rhino imposters doing what we do best, taking aim.